he talks, everybody goes silent.
House Committee on Judiciary come to order. Today is March 2nd. And we're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2733 and 2734.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2733 establishes the default legal rate of interest as the greater of 1% or the published weekly average one-year constant maturity treasury yield. The bill requires that interest be compounded annually on January 1st. House Bill 2734 modifies proceedings in small claims matters. The bill requires that small claims be prosecuted in the name of the real party in interest and prohibits any party from appearing in small claims litigation or mediation without an attorney unless a circuit court judge consents to that appearance. The bill requires governments, corporations, and other non-natural parties to appear through an officer or employee and allows one spouse to appear on behalf of the other spouse. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And Jeff Merrick can come up as well, please. Representative, please go ahead.
I think Jeff has presented his testimony in writing, and I...
Oh, okay.
Oh, here. Good. I heard you. Oh, that's good.
It's Boo. He's having trouble.
There's going to be somebody up here who knows what they're talking about. That's going to be very helpful.
We have somebody here that knows what they're listening about. But
I will introduce both bills. They were introduced at the request of Mr. Merrick. They seemed to me, I was particularly intrigued with the small claims court question of making the small claims process fairer for the individuals who show up in small claims court, and Jeff will explain that. I also was interested in the interesting, I think the interest one's a little more complicated because it goes beyond simply the small claims court and deals with other issues, but I really appreciate you hearing these bills, and I really hope we can move one or both of them forward.
Thank you.
Please. Chair Barker, members of the committee, thank you.
I think I forgot to introduce myself.
No, you did.
And in saying I'm representative of Mitch Greenlick, House District 33.
Hey, thank you.
Start again. Thank you, Chair Barker and members of the committee, for this opportunity to talk about some holes in the process that I think we really need to plug.
And you need to identify yourself for the record.
My name is Jeff Merrick.
Thank you, Mr.
And I got involved volunteering for the small claims courts in Clackamas and Multnomah County. I've been doing that for 5 years as a mediator for them on a volunteer basis. And for years, all of us mediators talk about some real issues that are of major concern to us, and there was finally one episode that kind of got me off my keister and got me to write something and got me to contact Representative Greenlick, who was kind enough to introduce these. And let me just start with that particular case. The statute doesn't talk about mediation, but courts are summoning people to mediation. And they summon this couple to mediation, an older couple, probably about 62, give or take. They were poor. They were proud. I could tell they were proud because their old clothes were very clean and tidy. Their hair was clean, but not dyed, not cut by a professional. It was gray hair.
Be careful now.
They showed up, and the woman was disabled, and these were some residual bills from like 5 years before that were being pursued against the two of them. And we sit down, and across the table from them is a professional claims advocate, not the person who held the debt, but a professional claims advocate. And we'll call the debt holder the Charitable Brothers of Good Medicine, for example. And so the claims representative says, this is what you owe, plus there's 9% interest over these last 5 years, plus court costs. You need to pay us $1,600. And you have a choice. Your choice is we'll get a judgment and we'll garnish your wages at 25%, or we can try to cut a deal. So the man kind of takes a big breath and kind of takes us all in. He looks to his wife. He couldn't sit still. He stood up. He starts pacing and he says, what are we going to do, honey? If they garnish my wages, we can't pay rent. What are we going to do? And she's weeping, and she's saying, I'm so sorry, I can't work, I'm so sorry. And he says, we'll get through it, we always get through it. And that's what said, we got to do something about this, because the person who was at the court didn't even hold the debt. If you looked at the court record, it didn't say Charitable Brothers of Good Medicine. It said ABC Collection Agency. And so what we've established, I've concluded, is a secret creditors court. You can't go and look up whose claims are out there. And I think that, not that you can read this, some of you have this in paper form, but the first question is, who's using the court? And our Constitution says we're not supposed to have secret courts. No court shall be secret. Justice shall be administered openly. So I think it should be a no-brainer that even if you allow claims professionals to represent one side, they should at least name who they're working for. We require that in every other lawsuit. ORCP 26 says you have to sue in the name of the real party in interest. Why should we allow secret creditors courts? We shouldn't. We should change it. There's no fiscal impact. One spouse is enough. That should be another no-brainer. These people who get called into court, you know, they've got child care issues. They can't afford to take a day off work. They're already in trouble with their bills. And sometimes Mrs. Jones shows up without Mr. Jones, and they say, well, I want a default judgment against Mr. Jones because he didn't show up for mediation. And that, again, should be a no-brainer, no fiscal impact. Let's get it done. You know, but otherwise, the concept of small claims court is a good one. The concept is that you have a judge who's there to dispense justice. The judge can level the playing field. The judge doesn't even have to follow the law. The judge just has to do what the judge deems is right, just, and equitable. So in that case I just talked about, the judge could probably say, you know, Charitable Brothers of Good Medicine, I'm not going to enforce a 9% interest. But a mediator can't do that. A mediator has to remain neutral. A mediator can't prevent a sharp bargain in mediation. And some of these people are not equipped to bargain with these people who do this every day in courthouses around the state as basically attorneys, but without the name attorneys for these companies. It's just not fair. And especially when you look at the law, and on the one hand, the creditors are represented by a professional advocate day after day, and the debtor is prohibited. A debtor can't bring in an attorney. A debtor can't bring in a paralegal. A debtor can't even bring in their savvy sister-in-law who knows something about law. It's always one-sided, one against the other. It's just not right. And the trouble, I mean, the good news about mediation and small claims is that we get a lot of good cases done and a lot of good work done. The bad news is that there's no one to level the playing field when it should be. And another example that we see, for example, is, you know, somebody has a used car. Somebody sells a used car with 200,000 miles, 30% interest, and they come in with a claim, you know, claims rep. And a judge might say, I'm not going to do that, but a mediator can't. So these people are coming in without any representation, and it's just not right when the other side has it. So the law proposes, forget it. Charitable Brothers of Good Medicine, you show up to these things. And I believe, for example, in that case I talked about, I think if there had been somebody from the hospital there, they would have said, okay, we're going to waive this. For you, we're going to waive this because that is part of our mission. But they didn't even have the opportunity to deal with it because they weren't there. Some technical things I mentioned with Mr. Nasby about there's another law out there, ORS 697.045, that would need to get wrapped into this. And we talked about the 9% interest. That's a big deal for these people. It sometimes, you know, after 5 years, it really adds up for these people. Whether it's for all claims or small claims court, you know, I leave that to your judgment, but certainly for small claims, I think that should be reduced to a market rate or 1%. That makes sense to me. And with that, I will shut up and let the other folks speak, unless you have any questions of me.
We could get an amendment to make sure that that interest rate really relates to small claims court only, which might make it more palatable.
There'll probably be some testimony about the problems with having it too broadly. And The reason it went to 9% was a few years, more than a few years back, the committee raised that because the idea behind that was to have people pay their debts promptly. Mm-hmm. That was the purpose of that. So, and I was going to ask, was this sold debt? Is this somebody that bought the debt that was in?
No, and that therein lies the problem. I have no problem with a collection agent that owns the debt and can negotiate on it. But what we see are these collection agents that don't own the debt. And then we ask, can you do it? The other side asks, can you cut a deal? And they say, no, we can't. Our principal won't let us. And the other thing that happens sometimes, it becomes obvious that the debt is just wrong. There was a record-keeping error or something. It's just wrong, and there's nobody there to deal with it. And so these people had to take a half a day of their work life, their life, to come to court for an error, and they can't get it straightened out there because the collection agent says, I have no authority to, you know, change it, even though I know you're right. I'm sorry, I can't do anything about it.
Senator Frederick?
Thank you very much, Chair Barker and members of the committee. It's good to see you folks.
Welcome home.
I don't see you as often as I used to. We'll see some of you anyway.
That's
anyway.
Hi, Lou.
Hi, Bill. I really don't have a whole lot to say. You've heard from the experts. Jeff came forward and asked for this to come forward. For me, as we talked about it very briefly, it is just simply about fairness in the legal system. What I want to make sure is that we have a legal system that has credibility, and when you see holes like this, it breaks up that credibility. So on both of these bills, I think it's important for us to really speak to how we can adjust it so that people will feel as though if they come forward, they can get really good support. I won't go into the details. You've probably already gone through the details, I would guess. But that's the basic concept for me. We will try to get something through, I hope, here.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Any questions for this panel? Representative Vile.
I just want to make sure that I understand the interest rate issue. How do you suppose a unsophisticated holder of debt would be able to quote someone their actual payoff amount if that interest rate had been fluctuating during the entire time that the debt was in place?
Yeah, thank you, Representative Vile. And I think that's a good question. I kind of cribbed that language from the federal court statute. And the federal court statute is confusing because it's every month. You got to do it every month. And that's why in my proposal, I just said, let's pick a date, December 31, just one rate a year, and to make it a little bit easier. But I think that in practice, what happens is the unsophisticated people have no clue. And what happens is a professional claims advocate will walk in and say, okay, these are your bills, and we've tacked on the legal rate of interest, and this is the total. And most people don't really even question it, honestly.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Please.
Jeff, I've done some of the same kind of work that it appears you're doing. And my experience was that 99% of these were settled in some kind of a compromise environment. So that what the interest rate was, what the original amount of the debt was, really didn't matter. What it came down to is, what were these folks really going to be able to pay so that the debtor could get something without throwing them into bankruptcy, and the creditor was able to get out of this thing as well. Doesn't the 9% leaving that there, doesn't that actually encourage folks who see their debt getting bigger to say, yeah, let's do something about this. Let's get this done.
You know, and I agree with what you're saying. I agree with what Chair Barker says about the need to have an interest rate so that people don't just feel like, especially big companies, you know, you get a judgment against, you know, Daimler for $700,000, and they're thinking, hey, it's cheap money to go appeal this forever. And so I agree with that concept. But what I'm seeing in practice in small claims, I had one just 2 weeks ago. A young woman had a very personal procedure done like 4 years ago, And she was, number one, shocked that this claims agent, who had nothing to do with her medical provider, had her records of her very personal medical records. But she didn't even know it was out there. She was a young woman. She moved frequently. They sent the bills to the old address. And finally, after about 5 years, they sent it off to the collection agent, who did track her down. And she's getting calls from somebody she didn't even recognize. This is whatever, OG Collections, please call us back. This is OG Collections, please call us back. She has no idea what they're talking about, so she just figures it's a scam. And so all of a sudden, she shows up, and same kind of a thing. A $900 bill is all of a sudden $1,500. And she just kind of like, you know, grudgingly like, what can we do, you know? So that is the problem, and that's the challenge, is how do you incentivize people to pay judgments promptly without hurting people? And that's why I feel like, you know, maybe a small claims court rate makes sense. We already have multiple rates. It's kind of ironic that if the patient gets a judgment against the healthcare provider, that's a different rate. That's 5% of our market rate. And so, I mean, there's already some carved out exceptions. I think carving out an exception for small claims department makes sense to me.
One last thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, I heard Representative Greenlick say maybe a small claims rate would be a good idea, and I like at least I would have a little bit easier time with that. I would ask that any other amendments, make sure that you carve out, for example, homeowner associations. We've got thousands of homeowner associations collecting key money to maintain their common elements. And the only way they can do that oftentimes is through some of these easier, less complicated routes. It's certainly better for the person being collected on to not have to go through an extensive civil action. So I would hope that we'd look at some of those sorts of things so that we don't have some severe unintended consequences.
Yeah, and I agree with you. And I think that it's just, I agree with you. We need to work through it.
Thank you.
I appreciate working with you on that, Representative Baum.
All right.
One other thing, Senator Frederick, would you just say your name because you forgot?
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm Senator Lou Frederick, District 22, North and Northeast Portland.
Thank you. Any other questions for this panel? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And next we'll call Chris Bevins.
Thanks so much.
And Aaron Nottenberg-Poe.
Yeah, Matt.
Oh, and Matt, come on. That's okay. Why don't we start here and then go ahead.
Mr. Chair, my apologies. I wasn't originally going to testify and leave this to Chris, but for the record, Matt Markey, on behalf of the Oregon Collectors Association today, I just want to say a couple of quick things. While we are opposed to both 2733 and 2734, as I listen to the testimony of talking about limiting this to small claims, you know, small claims is a lot cheaper not only for the folks filing the suit, but also for the debtor that is involved. And if you're going to push a lot of these into circuit court, it's not going to make this necessarily any easier for the debtor. It's going to make it much more expensive for the debtor. And while I can appreciate carving out certain segments of different types of debts that are owed, I think every debt that is owed has a unique circumstance to it, and that's going to become somewhat of a difficult task to try to compare one debt to another debt to see which one should be at this interest rate, which one should be at that interest rate. But with that, I'm going to let the true expert here speak to both of the bills, and happy to answer any questions if I can afterwards.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Chris Bevins. I work for a collection agency, Professional Credit Service. We are one of the largest in the state of Oregon. I am the vice president of legal operations. I'm also an attorney. I'm licensed in both Oregon and Idaho. And my job is to run the legal department. That department is my attorney team and my small claims, or litigators, as we call them. I can tell you that there are decisions made every day on which cases go where, but to give you an idea of how we decide where to send our suits, they're all based on the same criterion. We have an analytics team that looks at credit scores. We work with TransUnion on other factors of employment and whatever, and they provide us with a score. We go based off that score. And we look at just a variety of factors on whether or not this is debt that we should pursue or not pursue. Now, I heard the example that was given earlier, and I would suggest that that's a very, very, very small, limited circumstance, one that we actually try to avoid because it doesn't make us any money either, and it doesn't make our clients any money. So with that, when we decide to sue with an attorney or not with an attorney, it's all based on amount. That really is it. The criteria is the same. So wealthy people are being sued in small court, small claims court, and poor people are being sued in small claims court. But if they're poor, there are indicators that suggest they have the ability to pay, or at some future time will have the ability to pay, and there's a reason for us to get a judgment, and we'll wait out the 10 to 20 years hoping that their circumstances improve. That's just to give you an idea of how we choose where to sue. As far as small claims itself goes, it Marquis said, there's too many M's. We, as professional credit service, and I can't speak for other collection agencies, we're trying to improve the name of collection agencies. We know that there's a big smear on our on what we do, even though we believe we provide a benefit to society by helping collect accounts receivable. We believe that that keeps costs down. We believe it, it has many other benefits that benefit all aspects of society, government, industry. If we're not allowed to sue in small claims court, as Mr. Marquis said, there are significant differences. Right now, we file, this last month, I looked the numbers up for you, we filed just under 1,000 claims in small claims in the state of Oregon. In our attorney team, we filed under 50. Now, there's been a lot of talk about who the real party of interest is. In the state of Oregon, case law suggests and says that as an assignee, we are the real party in interest because we've taken that, we've taken the rights of the original creditor and we sue in our name because we now step into their shoes. That being said, there is some wording with the bill that I think would have to be litigated as to decide whether what fully assigned means. Fully is the word I don't like in this bill. I also think it's problematic to limit small claims because it does benefit in the sense that you're talking about a $53 filing fee versus a $158 filing fee. Oregon law is great in the sense that it tries to get everybody to settle outside of court. That's what it's designed to do. In small claims, you have mediation. When I sue as an attorney, if the amount is under $50,000, we have mandatory arbitration. Okay? No matter what we do, we have to go and try or discuss this matter before we hit the judge who actually makes, you know, the decision, although in arbitration there is an adjudication. But you can appeal it. So that being said, those 50 cases that our attorneys file would then suddenly bump up to 1,050 because we still can sue on those claims. We're just going to be suing with an attorney instead of in small claims, which means we're adding attorney fees if we are entitled to them, which any claim under $10,000 under ORS 20080, as long as we send a letter 20 days ahead of time, we're entitled to attorney's fees. So if the claim is valid, we're going to get it. Secondly, you're going to have an arbitration fee that both sides have to pay. The winning party recovers that as costs. So there's an additional fee. So suddenly, if you take, let's say, a $1,000 debt in small claims, it turns into a $1,053 debt plus a prevailing party fee of about $100. If you have the attorney sue it, it becomes over probably $2,000 or more. So it really is a big difference. Now, that benefits me. But as I said before, our company is trying to do what's right. So we run a lot of these cases through small claims in order to, one, meet the needs of our clients, the creditor who actually wants to keep the costs down. So we work off volume. We make our money off volume when we run through small claims. We take a percentage of what we get, and that's how we make our money. And we make less that way, but we make our clients happy, and we feel like we're actually contributing to the good name of what we do. Additionally, it's interesting to note that in Nevada, the state of Nevada, who also allows small claims, collection agencies in small claims, they also allow attorneys in small claims, but they just raised their limits from $10,000 to $15,000 as of January 1st because it's such an efficient process. Now, the case you heard earlier, it went to mediation, and in mediation they apparently came to an agreement, because every argument I heard Mr. Merrick make, the judge would have decided if it had gone to the judge. And that's where, you know, there are safeguards in place. We have to go in front of a judge and show our itemizations. We have to show the assignment that we do a lot of hospital debt. So say the hospital assigned a debt with us. We have to prove that the hospital assigned it to us. We have to show if there's a contract. We have to show the itemizations, where any payments were made, whatever. We have to prove the debt. That stays the same no matter what court it's in. So this idea that somehow there's a lack of fairness or injustice, it's just simply not true. The rules are the same. And in fact, in small claims, as it was previously mentioned, it's actually a little bit better, because the judge can hear, you know, the rules of evidence aren't there, so the judge can hear hearsay. They can listen to what the consumer has to say and apply their own sense of fairness, because again, small claims is not appealable. So it actually is still a great thing for consumers, and in some ways it's more balanced than anything. The reason, again, that we're opposed to this is mostly because we do run a lot through small claims to the benefit of the consumer. And ultimately, that's, I think, what our clients want, that's what we want, and I think it's what benefits our state the best, is to keep things in this balanced and fair system.
So I have a couple of questions.
Sure.
Mr. Merrick talked about only having one spouse show up. Would that be a problem to allow that?
No, and in fact, there was actually a lot of language in the bill that I liked. I did like that part, because part of my history is, before I started working for Professional Credit Service, I worked 8 years in my own private practice. So I come with an interesting perspective. I've worked on both sides of this issue, and I've had the conversation with the little old lady that is getting sued and can't pay, and asked my advice, and in her words, go work your magic, because I'll call and set up a payment plan or something. I just see it as a non-issue.
Okay. And then the other thing, the owner of that, so would it be a problem for you to come in and say, I'm so-and-so collection company representing Jeff Barker?
We do. In all our pleadings, it tells who the debt's from. That's where I don't understand that part.
Yeah, okay, that's what I didn't
we have
that
to. We have to come in and prove who the debt is for.
Okay.
And in some cases, we actually have to call our clients in to testify.
Okay.
We can sometimes do it by affidavit. Sometimes it just depends on which court we're in, because really it's an art deciding which county's small claims court requires what, to be honest with you.
And one other thing, so if I owe money to three people and they want to go to small claims court, and you can represent three so that those three don't have to come in, is that?
Yes, thank you. That's something I left out. That's another cost-saving provision that we currently have, which is I can take a hospital debt, a electricity debt, and whatever, combine them all together, sue at once, so there's just one $53 filing fee instead of three separate $53 filing fees, because I have to sue each debt separately. So additionally, another cost-saving case. And I apologize, Mr. Chair, I didn't fully answer your question. I personally think that allowing a spouse to speak on the behalf of the other spouse is fine. I actually inserted the word written permission, just so there's no question, because it does, you know, we do have those situations where we'll take default on one spouse because they didn't answer, where the parties probably assumed they were answering for both. So that part I'm personally not opposed to. I don't know how the rest of my industry would side.
Well, thank you. Any other questions? Representative Greenlee.
Can I ask a question? Thank you. Is it true that attorneys are not allowed to be representing clients in small claims court?
That is correct, Representative Greenlee.
When you come in as a collector, you pointed out you're also an attorney. Would you be representing, when you come in, are you representing your client as an attorney?
I am not allowed to go to small claims court because I am a licensed attorney.
So you can't represent your company because you're an attorney, is that right?
Correct. Unless I applied to the court for permission, but then it's only in very limited circumstances.
So somebody, you have to send somebody who's not an attorney to represent you.
That is correct.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Okay, we're going to have some more testimony, but Mr. Marquis, if you could maybe talk to the other, see if there's some.
Yeah, I can check on that for you. Sure, Mr.
Maybe get a needed amendment and see what
Thank
we
you.
Can do with this. Thank you. Next, I'll call Arthur Tower, Tim Cowan, and Lindsay Baker.
Chair Barker, for members of the committee, for the record, my name is Arthur Towers, political director for the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association. And I wanted, based on the testimony that we've heard today, I have a lot of confidence that we can work out our concerns with the sponsors who we have a tremendous amount of respect and fondness for. And so I think we can get something hashed out pretty quickly. But I just will say that where we were coming from is a concern that if, you know, David sues Goliath Industries for injuries caused by a defective slingshot, let's say, and wins an award of biblical proportions, the 9% interest is something that is provides an incentive to reach a quick settlement as opposed to the big guy starving out the little guy. But again, I have confidence we can work everything out, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Great analogy.
Thank you so much.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Lindsay Baker, and I am with the Department of Administrative Services, and I will keep my remarks specific to House Bill 2733 and not 2734, and this is the one that modifies the rate of interest. So the introduced language as it's written right now is fairly broad, and it would impact all of the debts that are owed to the state, as well as any contracts that the state is party to and any interest rates there. So this would require a significant amount of back-end work for all agencies and, again, all contracts that we're party to. So the calculation and then the notification to any other party about the fluctuation of that interest rate. So it seems to me, based on testimony that's already been given, that there's a lot of, you know, conversation about maybe narrowing the scope to just small claims. So we'd be happy to work with whichever members or folks are interested in working and getting to a solution.
Okay, thank you very much.
Chair Barker, mine is just on the loan on 2733. Okay. I don't want to waste your time if it's on small claims.
Okay, fine. Go ahead.
Oh, okay.
On the interest rate.
Just for the record, Chair Barker and committee members, my name is Tim Cowan. Just for a kind of a credibility standpoint, I retired as a senior vice president, regional manager for First Interstate Bank of Oregon. I was responsible for Mid Valley, Central, and Eastern Oregon. Okay. What I wanted to do is give you my notes so that I just don't ramble on like I'm doing right now. Who originates the loan? Such as a bank, trade, or shareholders. It's not uncommon that a shareholder will give a loan to a company also. What type of loan is it? So these all impact the interest rate. Does the borrower accept the terms? I don't know if that applies to this or not. Does it take into account how much the borrower will make? Now, one of the things I thought would be kind of interesting for you, because of the state, is discounted terms. When I'd have a lumber broker with 2%, 10, net 30, that meant if he came down and borrowed money from me, let's say it's 18%, so it'd be exceed this. Well, there are 18 20-day periods in a year, so he's going to make 36% interest. So he can borrow from a higher interest rate from me and make a 36% interest. Where that comes into the state is take a look at the things you do that apply as an interest rate but are really a discount because you pay a lot more money. And I can go into that at some point in time for you. What kind of collateral do you have? The terms, any future obligations to advance money to the borrower? Is the borrower vulnerable to a third party? If it's non-performing, can there be adjustments to it, such as maturity, additional borrowings, or reduce the value of collateral, because it's not uncommon sometimes when you make a loan that the value of the collateral goes down. That would happen a lot in an agricultural loan. If the trade modifies the terms, does that impact the rate of interest?
This is just for this, in small claims court, was what this was really addressing.
Yeah, that's why I wanted to know if you wanted me to.
Okay, well, I didn't understand you're going to.
Okay.
And so that's what we're going to take a look at modifying, just that one section.
Okay, sir.
But thank you very much, though. But I think that I appreciate you coming down. I'm sorry, but I think that, yeah.
That's perfect,
okay.
Sir.
Okay, thank you very much.
Chair Barker, we're done?
I am, sir.
I apologize. I also just want to clarify that we were testifying just on 2733.
Okay, right. Okay. Well, thank you very much, panel. Appreciate your testimony. Thanks for coming down. Sometimes the description of the bills are a little broad Okay, then I have Aaron Knott and Vera Poe.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Aaron Knott. I'm the legislative director for the Attorney General at the Oregon Department of Justice. We are here just on House Bill 2733. We're neutral on this bill. It is, I'll open by saying it was our read of the bill that this does not simply apply to small claims court, but instead would modify the collectible interest rate for all applicable debts. We're looking forward on this and trying to think through how we would implement this system within the Department of Justice. Sitting to my right is Vera Poe from our Child Support Division, not our Crime Victim Services Division. But CVSD is relevant because they are another division that has outstanding debts, restitution, crime victims compensation, and we've built our system around a static rate of interest. And trying to move from a static rate of interest to a fluid rate of interest is more than a bookkeeping problem. As was indicated by Ms. Baker in previous testimony, the amount of back-end work would be a significant fiscal driver for this proposal. So just to give a short description, I'll turn it over to Ms. Poe.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Vera Poe. I am the Policy Development Manager for the Oregon Child Support Program. I work in the Division of Child Support in the Department of Justice. My background, I am a licensed attorney, 27 years in Texas and 2 years in Oregon. I want to speak just to a few of the impacts that this measure, if passes drafted, would have on the Child Support Program and provide some information for your consideration. As Aaron mentioned, it would require significant system changes. Our current system, which you may be aware is in the process of being updated, does not have the ability to calculate interest. The impact of that is that individual customers have to provide calculations or the court has to do it. It's not any fun for anybody, and we have to check those calculations. We have designed a system which the design has already been completed that includes the ability to calculate interest, but it will calculate simple interest. And I haven't heard any testimony today about the feature in House Bill 2733, which requires compounding, but that is a significant change to a system. We haven't calculated how much that would cost, but I think it would be a lot. It would also very much complicate the review should there be a dispute as to whether prejudgment or post-judgment interest was calculated correctly. I've personally handled appeals on that issue previously in my career as a litigator. Also no fun for anybody. One other thing that I would like to point out is that the proposed rate, tying it to the federal treasury rate, is pretty much the lowest interest rate out there. And the prime rate that banks charge to their best customers is usually about 3 points before this. My litigation background was in banking litigation. So an impact that could occur is that child support debt, if subject to the statutory rate, would have probably the lowest interest rate of any debt by the party that owes it. And that could reduce the incentive to promptly pay it. In the context of child support, prompt payment is actually pretty important. It's not a matter of having the money so you can invest it. It's having the money so you can support your child, provide for the daily necessities. And so whatever the amount of interest is, if it's enough to promote prompt payment, that's going to promote payment. If it's very low, in fact, the cheapest debt that someone has, it's not going to do that.
Okay. Thank you. Any questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Okay, thank you. We're going to close the hearing on House Bill 2733, 2734, and open a public hearing on House Bill 2613.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2613 expands the crime of driving while under the influence of intoxicants to include intoxication resulting from any drug. The bill also eliminates the obligation of the state to specifically plead intoxication resulting from an inhalant or a controlled substance. For purposes of the public hearing today, there is a dash one amendment before the committee. The amendment creates an affirmative defense for persons who take the expanded list of drugs in accordance with the instructions and who experience a reaction that could not reasonably have been anticipated. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you. And today we're going to hear from the proponents. Some of the opponents were not able to be here today, so we will continue that at a later date.
So, Mr. Chair, I just, and colleagues, this is an issue that I've kind of dug my heels in over the last several years for not expanding what we do with intoxicants in this field. But the last few years, as I've been studying this more and seeing what's been going on across the country and everything, there's just such a variety of different substances out there right now that are being used that I have some serious concern with. And so that's why this bill is being presented to you today. It's been quite a bit of work on it, and those that are going to be sharing will really be able to kind of highlight a lot of the issues.
Okay, and first I have a couple of people who signed up as neutral on it, Dina Ryerson and Evan Sether.
Just 13.
Good afternoon, members of the committee, Chair Barker. My name is Dina Ryerson, and I work at the Oregon Department of Justice. I'm the DUI resource prosecutor, and I've been in this position for almost 11 years. So I'm going to just try. I know there's a lot of people testifying, so I'm going to try and keep this succinct since I want to show you this presentation. The current law is that to be found guilty of driving under the influence of intoxicants, you have to be impaired by either alcohol, a controlled substance, an inhalant, or a combination of any of those. The proposed amendment to this bill would include impairment caused by non-controlled substances, and not necessarily in conjunction with other controlled substances or alcohol, but if the only impairing substance is a non-controlled substance. This can take the form of a few different things. First of all, it can take the form of, let's say, a prescription medication that is non-controlled. It can take the form of an over-the-counter drug, such as cough syrup, which you'll see an example of in a little bit. And it can also take the form of an illicit drug that is a synthetic drug that people produce for the reason of becoming impaired, such as synthetic cannabinoids. And we'll talk about that in a moment. So this bill will only get to those substances that cause impairment and adding the controlled substances to the crime of DUI. The other piece to this bill to understand what the issues are with our current law is that our current law creates a loophole, and that is seen when you have a DUI that's charged where within the urine sample that's given, this is what Oregon does for drug DUIs, within the urine sample given there will be a list of controlled substances and there will be some non-controlled substances. So the way this is used and seen in court on a regular basis is the person will say, I was impaired, but what I was impaired by was a non-controlled substance. And that loophole creates a defense so that they can say, yeah, they admit to the impairment, but that impairment was caused by a non-controlled substance. Therefore, the DUI conviction can't stand. Sometimes it's successful, sometimes it's not. This bill has been in front of this committee for many years. and one of the concerns that has been raised is someone who is arrested and taking a prescribed medication or an over-the-counter drug that took it as prescribed and that they had an unanticipated adverse reaction. To address that, the Dash 1 amendments were filed, and it creates an affirmative defense for someone who will be able to say, look, I took it as prescribed, or I I took it as the packaging said, the over-the-counter packaging, and I had a reaction that wasn't anticipated. Of course, they'll have to give the prosecution notice ahead of time so that the prosecution can either dismiss it because they say that makes sense, or they can determine why they will say that doesn't apply. And finally, there is, on the Dash 1 amendments, there's a piece that allows the prosecution to have access to medical records only as they relate to the drug that's the claim of the affirmative defense, so they can put the facts in front of the jury and let them decide, or the judge. So that's the end of my testimony on that bill, and I just want to show you practical examples. I think we've talked about this over the years. As my position as a traffic safety resource prosecutor or DUI prosecutor, I get these calls, and so I see what is happening all over the state, and I just want to give you guys examples of what are actual cases that that have been forward. These are cases from all over the state. This one is from Deschutes County. It happened a year ago. It was a gentleman was driving on Highway 97, swerved across the center lane and crashed into a car that had a mom, a dad, who happened to be a firefighter. They lived in Vancouver. They were just down to Bend for the weekend, and their five-year-old son. It flipped the car. Individual admitted to taking 6 different prescription meds, none of which were controlled substances. Everyone at the scene knew he was obviously impaired, looked impaired. That included slurred speech, constricted pupils. He couldn't walk in a normal fashion. And the urine came back with only controlled substances. This is the result of the crash. That happened in this case. I was in conversations with the gentleman who was involved in the wreck. He wanted to come down to address you all, but again, he was working today, and anyway, he wanted to come down and show you what his life has been like since. There was some permanent injuries, but thankfully they were all okay. The next case out of Lane County, we tried to find some more recent cases for you. Citizen was seen driving, saw this person driving earlier, saw them weaving between lanes, causing traffic to stop to avoid collision. They continued to drive erratically and eventually missed a turn and crashed into a fence. When the officers arrived, the citizen was saying, there's something wrong with this person. They look impaired. The woman was unable to stand, was seen sprawled on the hood of her car. She was taking some prescription non-controlled medication, and her admission was that she took 4 instead of the prescribed 1 pill that she was supposed to take, and all her urine came back positive for non-controlled substances. The next one is in Jackson County. An officer observed the person drifting from side to side, crossed into oncoming traffic, and then back over the fog line, varying degrees of speed, and a lot of the signs of intoxication, slurred speech, very confused as they were talking to the person, and a drug recognition evaluation showed the pulse rate and blood pressure and vital signs way outside of the average range. The urine tested positive for Benadryl, NyQuil, and dextromethorphan, and so a combination of non-controlled substances. Did I just go backwards? I sure did. Okay, this seems like a lot of words, but I'll sum it up. Basically, a concerned citizen saw someone stumbling around Walmart, and I think at one point they said they thought he threw up right before he got into his car. He was seen driving all over the road. The officer finally caught up to him, and from even while he was driving, could see a blank look in his face. He cut across lanes of travel and to get onto I-5, and I believe that's around where the officer pulled him over. What was interesting is they found what was a package of synthetic cannabinoids in the car called Mad Pitbulls. And the crime lab, here's the other issue that a lot of people don't understand. Synthetic cannabinoids are included in the controlled substance list, except there are so many of them and the molecules change so fast, it is almost impossible to catch up to get them onto the controlled substance list because they just changed the molecule. And this particular one fit in what was called a catch-all. Unfortunately, our crime lab will not testify that these substances are what's called a cannabinoid receptor agonist. And that just means we can't testify that it falls in the catch-all. So it pretty much negates any synthetic cannabinoid that's not specifically named. This next one, I think this is one of the last ones,
This individual, this happened May of last year, bad driving, drove the wrong way down the road. In his car was sitting on the passenger seat was a bottle of cough syrup. He later, obvious signs of impairment, later admitted to drinking the entire bottle and that he does so on a regular basis, drink two bottles a day. And obviously the breath test was 00. So to illustrate the loophole, and this is the last one, this is a case where a gentleman was driving this truck, and on the side of the road were some workers, and they had their van on the side of the truck, and he basically ran into the back of their van. But in his urine was found Ambien and Flexeril, which is a non-controlled muscle relaxant, and the district attorney had a difficult time saying, okay, well, which one was the impairment attributed to? And so this is another situation where you have two substances, one non-controlled, one controlled, and one of the non-controlled are impairing. Currently, as we speak in trial in Lane County today, there's a case where a gentleman was had Whippets cans in his car, an inhalant, and he was driving a fourth of the mile with no wheel at all on his car and didn't know what was wrong with his car. And the defense is arguing that the two non-controlled substances found in his urine were the things that were impairing him. And that's all I have on this testimony.
This causes me to wonder about our whole enforcement environment. If somebody's driving, even with a non-controlled substance that they know is affecting them, do we not have any statutory authority to cite them and hold them responsible for having driven in an impaired state, regardless of what caused it?
Representative Barker, Chair Barker, and Representative Vile. Currently, in some of these cases, they could be charged with reckless driving, but what it doesn't attach with it is any of the treatment and assessment components that would go with that charge. And so you have people who are similarly situated that are impaired. One of them will get you all that comes with a DUI and some of the license suspensions to ensure public safety until they can get the ignition interlock and get back on their feet to assess what the problem is. And the other one doesn't come with all of that.
Follow up, Mr. Chairman.
Follow up, please.
So just a simple reckless driving ticket wouldn't necessarily have the same outcome in terms of their avoiding the same problem again. Is there a way that we could perhaps look at a change in the law that would add, well, let me back up. All of these non-controlled substances, well, maybe if you're using a cannabinoid, there's nothing on the label. But I would think most of these non-controlled substances have something on the label that says, don't drive with this because it's not safe. And if you disobey that label and drive, wouldn't there be a way that we in the law could hold that person as responsible as if they had driven under the influence of an intoxicant?
Chair Barker, Representative Vile, I think the issue is more that all of these are impairing substances, so it's treating everyone the same. And that's also part of the affirmative defense. The purpose of the affirmative defense is to say, hey, look, did you, you know, in all these cases, it's clear that this, drinking two bottles of cough syrup a day, that affirmative defense wouldn't be available to them. But in situations where they didn't anticipate the reaction, it would be available. Whereas somebody might not have a handle on a new medication that they took what they were supposed to, and, you know, so then they wouldn't get a DUI at all. But it creates equity in impairment as in driving.
Good. Thank you very much. Thank you.
And I just would say that when you say simple reckless driving, I can remember having a judge tell me that the difference between negligent homicide and reckless driving is a body. It's a pretty serious, serious charge to get a reckless driving. Okay. Go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Barker. A question on this. If it's a non-controlled substance and there's such a variety of things that people can take to intoxicate themselves, how do we possibly think that, or I mean, how do we accurately figure out what is too much and test that threshold that people would know this is the threshold? Who decides if it's not controlled to figure out when someone's had you know, a drink of cough syrup too much?
Chair Barker and Representative Stark, I think it's about the impairment. Mm-hmm. And so you have controlled substances currently today that you could say the same thing for. It's a matter of law enforcement observing them, and if they are observed to have mental or physical faculties that are impaired, it's really not till later on they figure out what actually is the thing that's impairing them. So it's not, this wouldn't increase the arrest for DUI because we don't find out till later that what was actually impairing them was only non-controlled. And so it's really about what is observed as impairment, and then the state has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that what was observed was impairment. There's a lot of cases where people have medical conditions. People like Sergeant Sether does a drug recognition evaluation that they say, you're not impaired, you have a medical condition. So trying to develop a threshold for every single drug out there, states don't do that because that it's different for everybody, especially with medications.
Follow up. Thank you, Chair. So you mentioned states don't do that. Are there other states that are, you know, doing a good job of navigating this issue, and what are they doing?
And Chair Barker and Representative Stark, 44 other states in the country have non-controlled substances as part of their statutes. We are only one of six that are currently with the statute the way they are now. A lot of the concerns over the years have said, well, we're going to be arresting people, you know, randomly when we would have never before. Again, these are the same people who are arrested because that's what the officer sees to take them off the road. So we aren't, I did a Google search of, you know, like caffeine. I know someone said, oh, there was a caffeine DUI out of California. Well, that ended up being debunked. They didn't charge the person with the DUI ultimately because caffeine came back in the urine and there was some other substances. So, you know, in doing Google searches and talking to my counterparts, I have counterparts across the country, they don't see those kinds of issues. So we're, again, only one of six states that currently are stuck on just controlled substances.
Okay. Thank you, Sergeant. Please.
Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Sergeant Evan Sether with the Oregon State Police. I'm state coordinator for Oregon's Drug Evaluation and Classification Program. It's otherwise known as a Drug Recognition Expert Program, or DRE as an acronym. So the Oregon State Police is neutral on this bill, but I just want to provide a little bit of factual information. I'm not going to go into detail regarding the DRE program itself, how it's developed, anything like that, and on this particular bill. I just want to get to the point of some of the data that's available through the State Police, through my program or through the Forensics Division, to address that. If I may, to begin, there was a question from Representative Stark regarding the testing thresholds. Ms. Ryerson did address that. There are currently no established thresholds for any of these other controlled substances right now. And part of that is, particularly with, you know, methamphetamine, cocaine, these other illicit substances which are controlled, there's no real hard line for any of that because of that. I think so far as we can tell right now, the science isn't establishing in quite the same way that it does with alcohol, where there's some sort of a clear line in the sand. So that being said, so the two sources that I'm going to be mentioning here, again, is the State Police Forensic Division and the DRE program itself. And these are going to be situations where only non-controlled substances were detected, so not in combination with controlled substances or other controlled medications, or in or mixed with alcohol. So to the Forensics Division, which does all of our urine testing and our blood alcohol testing here in the state, between January 1st, 2014 and through the early months of 2017, there were 251 urine samples that were connected to some sort of motor vehicle crime, largely and predominantly DUI, but sometimes in combination with hit and run or some sort of a fatal motor vehicle collision, maybe unauthorized use of a motor vehicle. So all of those were positive for only non-controlled substances. So there was nothing else in there. Sometimes they were mixed with other non-controlled substances. Certain examples maybe up there on that previous PowerPoint. They may have been mixed in with blood pressure medications, other things like that. But the important thing was I asked them to narrow it down to these non-controlled only situations. And there is the written testimony that I provided ahead to the committee has a list of perhaps 30 or so substances and the frequency with which they were detected. Now, there's no math required in this particular testimony here, but the important thing I want to note is that certain substances were detected, you know, with higher frequency
So don't add up all these numbers and expect them to reach 251, because a lot of times there might have been the active substance and then perhaps a metabolite thereof that was also included in it. But that just shows you the relative frequency of some of these drugs that we are detecting. Just to point out a few of them, the top one on the list, diphenhydramine, which is the non-trade name for Benadryl. You know, there's some other ones like doxylamine, which is the NyQuil, dextromethorphan, which is previous cough syrup medication that was mentioned earlier, cyclobenzaprine, which is Flextril. You should see both trade names as well as a drug name there, so it gives you some, and whether they're what they're generally used. But far and away, they are what we would classify in the DRE program as central nervous system depressants. There are a few that might straddle in some other different categories, but largely we're dealing with depressant type of medications. So that just gives you a little bit of a thing from the forensics division. Within the DRE program, since we don't do drug evaluations on every single person out there, we're only coming in times where somebody provides a breast sample under 0.08 and they consent to the evaluation and we are able to get a complete evaluation. I pulled some data that what we have available for the last couple of years, 2014 and 2015, where we have full year statistics for us. There were 94 evaluations that where subsequent urine samples were positive for only non-control substances. And this is only about 3% of the nearly 2,800 drug evaluations we did during that two-year period, as a matter of context for you. But of those 94 cases, DREs rendered opinions of drug impairment in 62. Now, your written testimony says 64. I went back and double-checked through those things, and it should be 62. So roughly two-thirds of the drug evaluations that ended up being positive for non-controlled only were DREs rendered an opinion of some kind of a drug impairment. The other 32 or so cases were people that were not impaired at the time of the evaluation. They might have been medically impaired, or they were impaired only by, say, alcohol at the time. So that gives you some kind of a context of the frequency with which we are encountering them, both at the forensic division as well as the state police and the DRE program. And as a result of that, because these are connected to driving crimes and largely with DUI crimes, we don't expect to see any sort of measurable increase in DUI arrests relating to this change, because we officers, as I'm responsible for training across the state in drug impaired driving, we should see no appreciable differences because officers are trained to arrest based on impairment at the side of the road. None of these screenings occur at the side of the road. We have no opportunity to provide that, to have that information ahead of time. We're only finding out about it once urine samples come back, and right now those are six to nine months delayed from the time of the incident is when we're finding out at that point. And at that point, then the prosecutors are making their have to make their filing decisions based on the information they have at the time. So that concludes my testimony. Actually, I apologize. There's one little thing I want to mention, the impact of the DRE program. There may be a very minor increase in trials where we'd be called and testified, but very, very little. And there would be no frequency change with respect to the how often DREs are requested by other arresting agencies. So that concludes my testimony. Happy to answer any questions the committee may have.
Any questions for the sergeant? Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony.
Thank you, Chair.
Yeah, Terry Timmius, Craig Campbell, and Robert Hayes, please. Go in any order, but please state your name for the record.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Terry Timmius. I'm a chief of police for the city of West Lynn. I also serve as a representative for the Oregon Associations of Chiefs of Police on the Governor's Advisory Board for DUII. I am before you today to offer my testimony and support for House Bill 2613, which would change the current DUI statute to include language of any impairing substance that are not controlled but can still impact a person's ability to operate a motor vehicle safely. Currently, a person can only be charged with DUII if the impairing substance is controlled by federal guidelines, is an inhalant, or is alcohol. But there are substances out there that I've seen over my 34 years of law enforcement that can impair somebody equally as bad as any controlled substance or any amount of alcohol. And those people are out there, killing our citizens. Presently, there are 44 states that have this language in their DUI statute, and Oregon is one of six that does not have that. And the problem with it not having that, the people that we are coming in contact on the roadways are not compelled to seek treatment, which increases the likelihood of recidivism. These people are going to reoffend, and they're not going to be held accountable as people are currently being held if they're under the influence of a controlled substance and or alcohol or a combination of all three. And as previously testified, this change in language is not going to increase DUI arrest. It's not going to put an added burden on the court system. It's merely going to hold the people accountable that we are already arresting. Like prior testimony indicated, we don't do blood, breath, or urine tests at roadside. We've already made our determination the person is impaired, and we find out much later what substance it was that impaired them. It's literally impossible for the state of Oregon and the federal government to keep up with all of the substances that are being manufactured every day that have impairing capabilities, that have a high potential for abuse and have addictive qualities when abused or not taken as recommended. It's for those reasons I strongly urge you to support House Bill 2613 and add that language to the statute.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Craig Campbell. I'm here on behalf of AAA Oregon in support of House Bill 2613. I'll keep my comments fairly brief, but obviously AAA is concerned of making sure that those who are operating motor vehicles on the road do so in a safe fashion. Part of that is making sure that you know what your responsibilities are when you get behind the wheel of a car, because when you do that, you impact not only yourself, but also the potential safety of those who are driving around you. Providing statutory reference to these substances, in addition to those that we as the public generally refer to as being intoxicating, is critically important so that I know when I get behind the wheel of a car, I take into account the fact that what I take for whatever reason might have an impact on my ability to operate that vehicle safely. And so I need to be aware that I have that duty so that I don't make the mistake of taking too much cough syrup or taking too much of my prescription drug and then not being able to operate my vehicle safely. So that's for those who are unaware of the impact of what they take. Also, there are those who use other substances that are not controlled substances in an addictive manner. One of the benefits of this particular language is that for those who do that, there is treatment and assessment that becomes available for those who are arrested for purposes of DUII for taking non-controlled substances, and that's very important to us. Basically, any legislation that's going to improve the likelihood that our motorists are operating their vehicles more safely is something that AAA is going to support, and for that reason, we support House Bill 2613, and thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Robert Hayes. I'm a patrol sergeant with the Albany Police Department and have been in law enforcement for 25 years. I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police, as well as the DUII Multidisciplinary Training Task Force, in support of this bill. Some of my testimony has already been given by others, so I'll keep it brief to other testimony I have. House Bill 2613 will also fix a loophole that has been used on a regular basis. Here's an example. I had a case go to trial last year where the person admitted to taking a combination of nine substances. One of the substances was controlled, eight others were not controlled. This person hit a parked car, a pole, and a witness called 911 when the person was appearing intoxicated. Upon contact, she indicated she did not even know she had hit a car. I conducted a drug evaluation on her, and she was clearly under the influence of a central nervous system depressant. The toxicology report showed she had two CNS depressants in her system, in addition to several other substances. One of the depressants was a controlled substance, and one was not a controlled substance. The defense argued that the impairment was caused by the non-controlled substance and not the one that was controlled. Linn County Judge Daniel Murphy believed she was impaired, but stated he could not find her guilty because he could not say which drug was psychoactive at the time. Judge Murphy has also written a letter of testimony to this committee expressing his frustrations in the aspect of Oregon's DUI law, and this is not a unique example. Linn County District Attorney Doug Martini has also expressed frustration with the law and wanted to, this commented to be known by the following. Quote, we have had a number of cases where both sides agree that the defendant is impaired. However, we bring in experts that argue about what the impairing substance was. This bill will reduce the amount of money that the taxpayers expend paying for experts on both sides who argue about whether the impairing substance is heroin or whether it's Zoloft. The defense pays lots of money to bring in experts who agree the defendant is impaired, just not by a controlled substance on board. The non-controlled substance, although impairing, serves as a masking agent that erases other impairing substances. We ought not endanger citizens by allowing such a glaring hole in the law. Finally, the cough syrup. I've had people ask me, so if I take too much cough syrup and I'm impaired, would that mean I would be DUI? Yes. And I tell the person, if you go to your local Walgreens and look at the shelf, it also has DayQuil, other medications that you can take during the day that does not make you sleepy or impaired. And with that, I will take any questions.
Okay, thank you. Any questions for this panel? Representative Vile.
You've said that it wasn't going to add to the number of arrests. And is that because you're not ever going to pull somebody over or arrest unless you see an indication of impairment in the driving in the first place?
Correct. When we stop someone, we don't know. They tell us what they've taken. They've had two beers, right? Or they,
the classic two beers.
Right? Or they're not always truthful with us. But we have to make our observations of how they're driving, how they're acting, and what they do on the field sobriety tests, and we make a decision to arrest. The substance that's in their system, they can tell us what's in there. We can think what's in there, but it's not confirmed until we get a toxicology report.
But you're not going to pull somebody over. This is not going to be the kind of thing that is going to lead to a citation or an arrest unless you actually visibly see impaired driving take place.
I forgot last time. Chair Barker, Representative Vile. Yeah, that is correct.
Okay, thank you.
Yes, sir.
Representative Gorsuch.
More a comment than a question. It seems to me that the question at hand is if somebody is driving recklessly, dangerously, they're impaired. In my opinion, I don't care how they got there. They simply are there. And I think that we need to expand this to include more than what we have now.
And thank you.
Chair Barker, I have to say, this is causing me to think about the whole impaired driving concept that we've been talking about over the last several meetings of this committee. And I think this is really helpful in thinking through how we may address some of those issues.
Great. Thank you. Representative Greenlee, please.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to talk about this definition of what an intoxicant is. For example, there's the term an inhalant. What's an inhalant?
Chair Barker, Representative Greenlee. An inhalant is something that a person will take in the fumes, such as if they open up, they put gas on a rag and they soak the rag and they huff the fumes of it. Spray paint into a paper bag and they huff the fumes. Also, nitrous oxide is another form of inhalant.
I inhale on asthma medication frequently on occasion. Would that, if I were driving under the influence of my asthma inhalant, would be the fact that I had an inhalant as opposed to how I was driving make a difference?
Chair Barker, Representative Greenlee, I do not believe so. I also take inhaler for coughing, and I've never been impaired by it. And in my 25-plus years in law enforcement, I have never heard of anyone being arrested by someone who has used an inhaler.
Oh, but if I were driving weirdly for some reason, it's safe because I don't drive anymore, but were I driving weirdly, which I've been known to do, not under the influence of any drug,
that we know.
And I was pulled over, and then I had a blood test, and I found I had this anti-asthma drug in my system. But the fact that I had that drug, even though it's not psychotropic in most ways, would it still be an indication then that I was driving while under the influence?
Chair Barker, Representative Greenlee, I don't believe, if it doesn't cause any impairment, I don't see the prosecution going forward with that case unless there was something else in the system.
May I follow just a little bit?
Please.
There are, the next category has to do with a lot of over-the-counter medication. Again, I was driving strangely. The question was, I'm driving strangely because I was taking a gastrointestinal drug. I was taking Pepto-Bismol. Let's say you find Pepto-Bismol in my blood and I've been driving strangely. Is the fact that I have an over-the-counter drug in my system automatically indication that I was driving under the influence, that I was impaired? I mean, I might have been impaired if I were taking Pepto-Bismol, but not affect my driving.
Right. Representative Barker, or Chair Barker, Representative Greenlick, I don't believe that that substance in the Pepto-Bismol would come back with an impairing limit in the blood. I think it would just depend on the totality of what's in the system, what the person's take, and what their impairment was. As stated before, we don't know. We're going by the observation of impairment. After we write the report and after the facts are given for the case, then that's for the prosecutor to look at and see if this is relevant for prosecuting or if they need to dismiss the charge.
Thank you. So the point I was worried about here is that there are many over-the-counter drugs that have a lot of effect, and you wouldn't be testing my blood until after you stop me for my behavior. But then the question is, what's the offense relates to what drugs I've been taking? And as the factor causing the impairment, right? So I think there's the possibility for this being not quite as clear cut as we've seen. Okay. I fear.
Chair Barker, Representative Greenlick. Well, the fact is, if whatever they're taking regards to over the counter is impairing that person, then they shouldn't be operating the vehicle, because if they're impaired, then they could crash and kill or hurt someone.
Making an assumption that the behavior was related to a drug. You're not making the assumption that they are taking a drug and were impaired, and therefore the drug caused the impairment. That's the link that makes me a little nervous.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
That's not the way that the bill reads, at least. The bill reads any other drug as defined in 475.005, and 475.005 basically talks about any kind of drug, non-food drug, that adversely affects a person's physical or mental faculties. So I think the judge would...
To a noticeable or perceptible degree.
To a noticeable or perceptible degree. The judge would have to be convinced that it had been the drug that affected your faculties to a noticeable or perceptible degree before you could be...
The prosecutor would have to.
Yeah, well, the prosecutor doesn't get to make the decision, but yes. Yeah.
Well, he gets to make the decision what I'm charged with, whether I'm
that's
charged
right.
with driving while impaired or just being a weird driver, maybe. I mean, I do a field sobriety test if I was driving. I sometimes struggle finding my nose under normal circumstances. It's the possibility of upcharging based on something they find in my blood, and it's that assumption that what was in my blood is what caused me to be wobbly in the field sobriety test.
Yeah, that connection would have to be made, I think, before a conviction could be secured in any event.
Representative
Springer.
Springer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Questions over here.
So,
apologize.
So, to the officers, as I think through this, whether somebody's called it in or you see poor driving habits that will initiate the stop. But it doesn't jump from bad driving to there must be a chemical present. It next then goes to the DRE portion of this, seeing that there is an impact of a chemical substance, right?
Correct.
We're not just making an arrest based on bad driving. So there has to be the presence of some impairment that seems to be related to a chemical influence, and that's how you move forward.
Chair Barker, Representative Springer. Yes, the DRE doesn't happen, though, until after they submit to a breath test, after they've been arrested by the officer. So the officer basically stops the car, they get called in. We're going to make observations. If we see observations of impairment, we're going to do field sobriety tests, make an arrest if we feel that they're impaired to a noticeable and perceptible degree. And then they go to the station. Provide a breath test. If that's under 0.08 and it's not consistent, then a drug evaluation is conducted, and that's when that opinion can come in.
Okay, thank you. Representative Gorsuch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The other thing, too, is that through common experience, both district attorneys, and judges, there's going to be a pretty good consensus that if Representative Greenlick is taking Metamucil, that it didn't cause you to have some sort of weird reaction. I mean, I'm just saying that there are certain things that we're going to want to look at, right? But I don't think Pepto-Bismol and things like that would commonly be considered something that would trigger that. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much, panel. Call Kurt Miller and Kate Duke.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker and members of the committee. My name is Kate Duke. I am the current vice chair for the Governor's Advisory Committee on DUII and a board member for Lane County Chapter of Mothers Against Drunk Driving. I'm also a victim of DUII, a survivor, and have lost loved ones to this crime. I'm not going to waste your time with a bunch of repetitive things that you've already heard. You have my official testimony. MAD strongly supports this bill. It is my opinion as an individual, as well as a representative of MAD, that it doesn't matter what the impairment is. If an impaired driver hits somebody and seriously injures them or kills them, they are just as dead and just as injured, regardless of what the impairment was caused by. My fiance was killed by a drunk driver, and it wouldn't matter if it had been caused by Benadryl or the alcohol that the driver was actually impaired by. He would still be gone. And for many, many years after my fiance was killed, I harbored a great deal of anger to the driver that killed him. But there did come a point in time when I realized that he was just a person. He was just a regular person. He had a problem, and he needed help. And a lot of people out there abuse cough medicine, Benadryl. I personally know many people who have problems with this, and they need treatment. They need help. So this bill, it offers public safety. It helps make our streets safer, and it gives an opportunity for these people who do have a substance abuse problem a doorway to walk through to get help for that problem. So I ask you, as an individual, as a representative of MAD and the GAC on DUII, to please support this bill and move it forward. We need this. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Please.
Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee. My name is Kurt Miller from the Marion County District Attorney's Office. I'm also here on behalf of Oregon District Attorneys Association. As you can imagine, we support this bill. I'm here to tell you just a few reasons why, though. I'll start with a little bit on my background because I think it helps to balance off some of the testimony that you've already heard today. I've been in law enforcement for 17 years. Six of that was as a police officer in Arizona, a state that does have any substance that causes impairment. I've also been here at the district attorney's office for over 10 years now. I believe that this first thing is mainly, as Ms. Ryerson points out, is closing this loophole. As is pointed out, it doesn't matter what causes you the impairment. It's just a matter of what do we see. To address Representative Greenlick's issues, I think I have two comments on that. Without a doubt, there are going to be people that have some substances on board that may have reactions to it that they don't expect. As the officers testified to, the one main issue they do on a drug recognition evaluation is to determine if there's a medical condition. There's a medical rule out that goes with that. If they find a medical condition that's causing the impairment that they observe while driving, then that's not charged as a DUI. That's not what we're here to talk about today. We're here to talk about the examples that Ms. Ryerson provided to you. I'll also tell you that this is also not a very significant issue. We're not going to see a huge uptake in cases, as they've said. I ran some very basic numbers from our office just to kind of give you an idea, to put it in perspective to a county like Marion County on what we charge. Last year, officers from the varying agencies in Marion County submitted us individual charges at the amount of around 16,745 charges to our office. Out of those charges that they sent us, we filed around 12,806 based on our determinations of what was appropriate. Talking just about DUIs in Marion County, we had received from those agencies 934 charges. So requests from the officers, this is what we believe is a DUI in this case. We filed 856 of them. That leads to the question of what happened to those other like 80-something cases. Many of those we're sitting and waiting right now for labs. We wait for the lab results to come back before we make a determination if we're going to file those charges to see if it's a non-controlled substance or a controlled substance. Out of the 22 that we said we are not going to file, only three of those were non-controlled substances. So it's not a humongous amount of cases we're talking about here. So that's why I don't see this as really any fiscal impact. As everyone testified to already, we're going to have the same initial process. Officers make their decision. We wait for our labs. The lab's got to do it no matter what. And then you'll have maybe a few more cases that are filed. That actually won't cause more. That actually might cause some savings. And here's why. I'll start first with, and I believe it was Representative Vile that was talking about why not reckless driving or is there some other way to do this. It's actually a benefit to the person to have the DUI charge, which may sound odd to you, but a DUI comes with the ability of diversion right up front, which means that if they go through the treatment, if they are successful on that, which is what we want, people to be safe drivers, then the charge is dismissed and they have no conviction on their record. If we cannot file based on a DUI because it's not a controlled substance, we may sometimes charge a reckless driving because the behavior is just so bad that we are concerned about that. Reckless driving is not something that we have a program where we dismiss it at the end, and is also a crime that is not expungible from your record. So this is something that actually may have a more of a negative impact on the individual that is arrested and cited because of the fact of it's not a DUI that recognizes that they need treatment, that they need help for this. So that's one of the reasons why I think that in the beginning that's going to have a benefit to the individual. And secondly, it is going to have some cost savings. I think once a defense attorney, as Ms. Ryerson pointed out, I have heard those arguments that it was the non-controlled substance versus the controlled substance that was impairing them. And I think if we close this loophole and we don't care what it is, you were impaired, that would then allow us as prosecutors to work more closely with the defense attorney saying, look, here's the issue. How do we resolve this case shy of a trial? Because right now, if I was a defendant and I was arrested for DUI and I could say that it was the non-controlled substance, I'd go to trial too. So we're encouraging the trials based on that loophole. Closing this loophole means that we would probably have less trials, actually, and that would lead to cost savings on the individual officers coming in, so all of those agencies, the crime lab having to come down and testify. And as many of you know, that most of our defendants are from the court-appointed attorney side of it. And so that's fees that come out from all defense attorney experts as well. So that's savings that they could then use to represent other people that need the money more than just this person who obviously was impaired. So I do think it will help on that avenue as well. The last piece I want to touch on is the affirmative defense. As Ms. Ryerson talked to you about, the affirmative defense may seem like it's a burden that we're putting on somebody else to come in here and say why they weren't impaired. I have to tell you that obviously our burden is proof beyond a reasonable doubt, as it well should be for anyone that's facing a crime. But if I was trying to prove that a person was not impaired by a non-controlled substance or prescription medication, how could I do that? How could I disprove that beyond a reasonable doubt without that person coming forward and telling me what doctor prescribed them? I would actually have to subpoena every single doctor in the state of Oregon to say, did you prescribe this person medication? And it's just unreasonable. So giving them that little bit of burden to come forward and tell me what it was, that's just going to lead to resolution of cases. The last thing I'll touch on relating to that on the affirmative defense, that's the same thing we already have in controlled substances. If somebody's pulled over and they have a prescription medication in their car, and the officer's like, do you have a prescription for this? And they're like, yes, I do, but I just don't have it with me. The officer could choose to charge that person with the unlawful possession of a controlled substance. When the defense attorney or that person brings to the district attorney a valid prescription, that's an affirmative defense. And as soon as I see that, I dismiss the case. So it would be the same in this case. They bring me the information, they bring me the medical records, they bring me the support for that. And I look at it and I go, there's no sense in going to trial on this. You obviously have an affirmative defense, and so why are we going to waste anybody's time? So it's a good thing to have an affirmative defense. And if anybody has any questions, I'd be happy to answer them. If not, thank you for the opportunity.
Any questions of the panel? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2613, and we're going to hold the 2614 over. We will be too short a time today to hear that. Is there any further business to come before the committee? Committee, we stand adjourned. Thank you. Come before the committee. Committee, we stand adjourned. Thank you.